Thank you for joining me for a coffee with the editor. I'm with James Holly. It's been a while since I think the last chat was in October. 20 additional locomotives to your fleet. I mean, that's impressive.
All of them have been through, or will have been through, a major refurbishment process through our Roslyn workshops. So 20 locomotives over a period of about 18 months. You can imagine how much activity that's translated to for us at Roslyn. A lot of exciting solutions that we're bringing together there. Some of the locomotives have been through a lightening process to reduce their weight, to enable us to deploy them more widely. Some of the locomotives that required modern control systems have, we've been working with TMV in the US on control system solutions for both our older generation GE and EMD fleets, new control systems for both our U20C fleets, our GT22 fleets, and our GT26 fleets. Our last Afro 4000 locomotive, the parts procurement process on that for the repair of that locomotive, that was the one that was bought accident damaged out of the liquidation auction. That locomotive is now an active rebuild, which is brilliant. We've got all the component parts for that, and we're expecting that locomotive in service by the middle of the year. All in, 20 locomotives operating across 8 countries in Africa. It's a good thing. Extra locomotives. It takes our complete fleet size now to about 60 locomotives.
Aside from the 20, the rest of the fleet, I'm assuming, is all deployed.
Yes, our fleet is 100% deployed, and in fact, we are contracting locomotives now well in advance for the locomotives that are coming out of Roslyn in future.
With a fleet your size, how do you maintain that operational efficiency, especially when we talk about digitization and the tools around that, to make sure that you maximize your fleet? What are you putting in place?
So we've had to digitize a lot of our processes and our systems over the last couple of years in order to be able to handle the expansion. The first is a system that we put in place in order to oversee our ISO and RSR documentation process and process and procedure systems. Big process when you've got 12,000 control documents. That's fully implemented and up and running and working out really nicely for us. We've also looked to digitize our maintenance processes at all of our sites, as well as our job card system at all of the remote sites. Enables a real-time position on our stock holdings at circa 25 sites that we're now running in the 8 countries, which enables us to immediately work into our supply chain department to ensure that all of the sites are adequately stocked at all times. But it also translates to an enormous reduction in the amount of paper that we're processing across the business by digitizing all of our maintenance forms and processes on a daily basis.
Easy access to see what's happening.
Yeah, and then the data, of course, that translates to also is a very valuable tool. So that is a system that we implemented last year as well, which is brilliant. Insurance is getting harder and harder. Insuring our fleets is getting harder and harder. The insurance markets are just tightening up across the board. So we've had to introduce a system that reduces the risk of operation of our fleets. Speed control on the locomotives. We have data loggers on the locomotives. We've digitized the vigilance system on the locomotive so that we can move away from the older generation locomotives when you can bypass the vigilance. The trains now have automatic brake application, emergency brake application, automated emergency brake applications, all in an effort to reduce incidences that we find, reduce the severity of derailments if they happen, and take away the risk of derailments to the extent that we possibly can. So that's also been another very important development for the year. And if you're going to develop and deliver a massive expansion in future, especially with the South African market potentially opening up, the only way, to my mind, that you're going to be able to deliver that is with a massive investment into operating and maintenance systems. The skills base is really stretched. If we're going to take railways in the region to the next level, we can only do it through a massive investment into systems.
So you were talking about the amount of data. What of that data have you found the most valuable? Because I'm sure it's exciting to now actually have access to that kind of information.
We have all the data available. I mean, it was just it was in paper form in the past. So if you were to say to us, how many 761 823 traction motor failures have you had in the past, and how does the 823 compare to 824 in terms of reliability? We'd have all the data, but we'd have to go find it. Now that we've digitized the process, we could tell you immediately how many 761 823 traction motor failures we've had in the last 6 months versus 761 824 traction motors we've had in the last 6 months on the different fleets that we either maintain or own ourselves.
Do you think in the long term that will then lead into some of the R&D that you might look to in the future?
It's going to translate to a lot more efficient utilization of our fleets. If the industry per se has the information immediately to hand to say this is where there are potential weaknesses in the fleet, and then you can get down to why are there potential weaknesses. We found, for example, when we were running trains that we with hindsight found were too long up the escarpment on the Calabash service, that we were starting to lose an abnormal number of 761 A24 traction motors in the GEC 30 fleets. By dropping the load by just about 8%, we significantly reduced the number of failures we were having on that. But that extra piece was just pushing those fleets too hard, despite a world-class bright star control system in place, which is there to protect the assets. But you learn that with data. And when you have a smaller fleet, that it's easy to track that data because it's readily available. But when you have a bigger fleet, you have to start to digitize the process.
Where are you with your Class 39? Is it out now? All the Class 39s, I think you bought five.
Yeah, so four of the five are now in service. They've been sent up to a customer in Africa, and they're in service and operating nicely. And then the fifth Class 39 is waiting for a control system upgrade. And then we are going to be putting that into service in the next 3 months.
So obviously Roslyn is busy, not just with your own fleet that you're busy with, but customers?
So we've done a lot of third-party rebuilds as well out of Roslyn. We've got 11 locomotives that will complete in the course of this year that are already contracted. Three of those we're going to be doing at customer sites outside of South Africa. The balance will be done in Roslyn. So in addition to what we're doing ourselves, we've got those also coming out of Roslyn. That takes us too close to our current capacity, which is, so it's not only our existing fleet that's deployed, but also we're getting close to our Roslyn capacity. So we're looking at an expansion of capacity at Roslyn. When we did the main Roslyn project, we didn't upgrade our parts stores. So we've decided to progress with an expansion of the parts stores. What that means is that we can take the parts, engine blocks, for example, that are currently on the floor at Roslyn, and we can take them all out into the parts store. So we're going to be building a new state-of-the-art parts facility, and then we're going to be taking all of our parts out of the floor into that facility. What that does is, of course, increases significantly your control over the parts. Not that we've really had a problem with that in the past, but it does, which is a nice benefit. But it also creates a lot more space on the workshop floor.
In doing all of this and working on all of these locomotives, how are you doing with skills development?
So you've got to look at it in two ways. We've of course got this apprenticeship program that we've been running for a number of years, 18 years now into that program. We took our biggest intake of apprentices this year, and that's 10 people. The Tita has come back on board, which is brilliant, and we really appreciate the support of working with Tita on that. And that's how you fill the skills with from the bottom. You know, that's a massive investment into those people. It's a three-year training course, and it's diesel and electric fitter Red Seal qualification that they leave with at the end of 3 years. So, you know, that's how we fill the skills base from the bottom, which is vitally important. But with expansion, you've got to bring in the highly skilled, experienced technicians as well. And we've been busy with a big recruitment program to try and identify the highly skilled technicians too. It's been quite concerning for the future of expansion, how difficult it has been to source those skills in the market. I think there's been a lot of attrition of skills in the market, and sourcing those skills has been a challenge. We have been able to find the skills that we need, but we are actively looking for the best skills available in the market to come and assist us delivering a really, really high quality product.
Talking about your apprenticeship program, how are we doing on gender? Are you seeing women coming into this space, or is it still very male dominated?
We did have our first female apprentice qualifying from the school, which we're very proud of. And we are seeing more and more ladies join the program. It is still male dominated though. And we've said we've got a problem. Nani, that runs our brand and communications team, has started an amazing program, which is the Women in Rail program. And the future of rail is women. You know, I think when you've identified that there's an issue, you've got to address the issue and own the issue and accept that we've got an issue, and that's what we've done. So we're trying to position ourselves as a business that is the kind of business where women want to work.
25 sites in 8 countries, current status, in your view, of rail operations in Africa, and have you found it to be more progressive than it was previously?
So, Philip, if you go back a number of years and just think back to, you know, sort of 5, 6, 7 years ago, I think the only country where a private operator could run its trains under access was in sections of Mozambique. And then you take a look at the position where we are today. Private operators can run their trains in parts of Namibia, in Zimbabwe, in Mozambique, in Zambia, Tanzania, DRC, Senegal, Gabon, Egypt. Just in the last 3 months, we've had announcements from Tanzania for the standard gauge and central line. We've had announcements from Kenya. We've had announcements of broad-scale open access in Zimbabwe. So those are three countries that are changing policies announcements just in the last 2 months. There is a big push to change the way that railways run regionally, and it's being implemented very fast. And, you know, with that, it's brilliant for inter-regional trade because now you can have trains crossing borders, you can have seamless operation of trains across regions, and you can have the stimulation of regional trade.
So with that in mind, and the increased potential growth for you as a private rail operator and supplier of fleet, what happens come 1st of April when you can operate here, so we think? What fleet are you going to have available?
So we've got nothing available. We could reposition a couple of trains out of Africa and bring them to South Africa to run in sort of a pilot arrangement or an early start type arrangement, which might be a good idea. But you have to understand something about the South African freight market, which is fundamentally different to the regional freight market. You know, if you compare the rail freight market that exists in South Africa at the moment, you're looking at 77 million tons, which is the reduction in transit over the last 5 years in terms of tons that has moved. You look at that area study that was done at the time of the Economic Reconstruction and Recovery Plan that said there was an additional market over and above the 226 million tons that was moved in 2018 by Transnet of about 57 million tons. So you're looking at about 130 million ton market potentially available of rail freight in South Africa. Now compare that to the copper market out of the DRC and Zambia, which is a highly refined product, high-value product. All of the logistics pressure that's put around that, the road trains that you see on the N1, the N3, the trains that run to Lobito, to Dar es Salaam, the trucks that run to all of the available export ports in the region, that's about a 3 million ton refined copper market at the sort of top end. And then you're looking at a similar market for reagents back, some project cargoes. You're probably looking at about a 7 million ton market there. Compare that to 130 million ton market in South Africa of rail freight. Now, that means that in order to be able to service that in South Africa, you have to see a massive investment into new train capacity. And you're talking about 120 billion rand, we think, more or less, of new train capacity that's needed in South Africa. If you're talking about that kind of investment into new train capacity, you're not going to be able to meet that investment through the refurbishment of older generation rolling stock. You're not going to be running 50 to 75 wagon trains with 2,000 horsepower, 40-year-old locomotives, no matter what new control system you put in them. You're looking at new build programs. If you're looking at new build programs, you're talking about very expensive assets, circa $4 million for a new locomotive, anything from $75,000 to $150,000 a wagon, hundreds of millions of rands a train, 120 billion rand to service the available market. How do you make that work? Well, you make that work with efficiency. Okay? And what's necessary for efficiency is an extremely high quality underlying infrastructure. And underlying infrastructure means the quality of your track and the quality of your signaling solutions and the quality of your operating systems that the infrastructure manager applies in order to operate the trains. Now, those are the fundamental tenets that's necessary in order to see the train investment come. So now then we go, okay, where are we in the reform process in South Africa? National Rail, we've got the white paper into National Rail Policy, we've got the private sector participation framework, we've got the freight logistics roadmap, all approved by cabinet. All of them pointing down the direction of the concessioning of sections of the infrastructure in order to upgrade its condition. So where should the focus now be as a nation? In my view, it should be, how do we upgrade the condition of the infrastructure to create the efficiency to enable this investment into the huge train capacity?
So I hear you on all of that, and I agree with you because, you know, we're still waiting for the network statement, and I think the network statement is due the 1st of April. I hope they make that deadline. And in there, I'm assuming that they would have rationalized the network down to probably 12,800 kilometers, I think, with the statement of its condition. And then obviously, well, not perhaps not so obviously, the amount of work that needs to be done at certain parts of it to bring it up to standard? Because you guys need to have that standard in order to keep your locomotives on track. So what happens when that comes out and the likes of yourself and perhaps other players in the market have no rolling stock to supply our market? What do we do?
The investment cases that are going to be the first ones to come to the market is where you have a big delta in price between road freight and rail freight. And those markets are in the bulk markets. So it's where road trucks are used in order to transport coal, manganese, chrome perhaps. Those type of markets is where you're going to see the first train investments. Because you can price your rail service at a level that includes a certain level of efficiency adjustment because of the condition of the base infrastructure. But remember that the bulk lines and the lines that, and not necessarily the dedicated bulk lines, but the lines that move bulk in South Africa are a small fraction of the total network. You're talking, if we're still talking about the total 22,000 kilometer network, you're talking about probably 15% of the network is the lines that move bulk in South Africa. You'll see some train investment into those sectors. It's good. It's great. I sincerely hope it happens. And of course, we would love to participate in that. But if you want to see the broad scaled investment into train capacity across South Africa, that will really unlock massive upstream economic growth. You need to see that number that is starting to be spoken about in South Africa of between 150 and 200 billion rand being invested into the base infrastructure before you see the 120 billion rand circa that needs to be invested into trains. Then you've got a highly effective, a highly efficient core rail network in South Africa. And we've got one huge advantage. It's a big freight body. As long as that upstream freight body exists, the investment case exists into the base infrastructure, and it exists into trains. Refurbishment of rail track is a small fraction of the cost of building new rail track. We don't have to, as a nation, go and build a new standard gauge line from Mombasa up into Lake Victoria. Okay, we have a big advantage as a country in that the base infrastructure is already there. The refurbishment of it is a smaller piece. It could be the most wonderfully economically enabling thing. And everything that government's doing in terms of policy is heading in that direction. The real question is, how quickly can we get ourselves to that point where we have spades in the ground and these projects are being delivered? That is the question that everybody's asking at the moment is how can we translate these approvals from cabinet into practical investment?
Yeah, so I think that's the biggest concern. You know, we've been talking about third-party open access, private sector participation specifically in the rail sector for a very long time in its different forms. And now that it's, when I say now that it's almost around the corner, is it really around the corner? Because we've been saying that for some time as well. I think my biggest concern is that we're going to get to that point and we're not going to have the rolling stock available to see the private sector participation in that third party open access, because there wasn't sufficient policy certainty to begin with. So I remember when we first started talking about this, you were talking about 150 billion or how much was it? Or 2 billion? I can't remember. That's the kind of investment that you were as a company looking to make in terms of building new trains or locomotives with that added value of localization and local content. Is that still part of your plan?
The unlocking of any train in South Africa is going to depend on, of course, the terms and conditions of access. And we will wait to see when that comes. But it's also going to depend on the efficiency that the private operator can achieve in order to justify the investment case into the rolling stock in the first place. Those business cases that we started to develop at the time were based on an efficiency assumption that I think has moved. We now need to see the investment into the infrastructure happening. And it's not a maintenance investment into the infrastructure, it's a recapitalization of the infrastructure to get itself to a position where you can achieve great efficiency on the lines to justify investing hundreds of millions of rands a train. If you don't have the efficiency, the difference between cycling a train 3 times a month and 4 times a month is enormous for the business case of that train. And that's what it all comes down to in our business, is how many times can you invoice for a train every month? And the number of times you can invoice for a train every month depends on how many times you can turn it. The number of times you can turn it depend on the base level of the infrastructure.
So leading into all of that, I would think that the biggest customer, or perhaps potentially the biggest customer, is probably the customer in the mining sector, who most already have third-party operators running infrastructure or rolling stock for them, the ability to either hook and haul or just go from their plant onto the line. Do you think the mining sector has seen this opportunity in its reality? And do you think that perhaps, you know, I've just been reading things about some of the mines who are really being impacted by poor rail performance. And obviously, you know, there's talk about retrenchments and all the rest of it. Do you think they see the opportunity?
They do. They most certainly do. But whether it's translating into practical and planned investment, I'm not aware of it. If it is the case, if there are business cases being developed for their investment into extra train capacity by the mining sector in South Africa, we're busy with some programs with big mining customers to look into the feasibility of investment into trains. And in certain sectors, as I've said, with this big delta between road and rail capacity, it's promising. There certainly is opportunity for specific investments into trains for some sectors. And there are some customers looking at it, which is brilliant. But I do think that at the moment, most of the South African mining industry is waiting and seeing what comes out in terms of the network statement and the terms and conditions of access. They want to see what that looks like first before going to develop the business cases associated with the investment into that. I do think that no matter what happens with the successful rollout of the concessions which will upgrade the base level of infrastructure in South Africa, there is a rail boom coming in South Africa because there is still a big freight body in these bulk sectors that do require extra train capacity. There is a rail boom coming. There's no doubt about that in my mind. But is it going to be the solution for broad-scale economic growth in South Africa? That requires the successful rollout of the freight logistics roadmap and the private sector participation framework to see the broad-scale upliftment of the base level of infrastructure. However we look at this, there's going to be an investment of a certain scale. It's going to be a relatively exciting time. I just hope that if we can get it right, it could be the most enormously exciting time for the economy of South Africa by unlocking this, instead of just a limited sector, which is certain bulk customers in South Africa.
So I'm quite excited. You know, so long as it happens, I've been saying I'm quite excited for probably 2 years now. So I'd really like to see this happen. And in saying that, you know, with Transnet having done its vertical, so it is vertically separated now from an accounting and physical perspective in terms of, you know, the Transnet train operating company and then the infrastructure manager. And yes, there are policies that still need to be put in place, or economic regulation, more to the point, that still needs to be put in place. Do you think that the infrastructure manager is sufficient, a infrastructure manager? I mean, I think that network's quite big. How is, in your mind, how do you think that's all going to come together?
So two things. I think that firstly, I'm very interested to see how we're going to separate the infrastructure manager from the infrastructure owner, because I think National Rail policy is very clear. It talks about the separation into three parts: train operating company, infrastructure manager, infrastructure owner. So the separation of the TRIM into the infrastructure manager and the infrastructure owner at some stage in the future, I think, is very extremely important for the successful rollout of reform. And it's going to be interesting to see how that next step is taken. So that's the first point on that. And then the second is, if we go back to when the container corridor operating lease was proposed at the beginning of last year, let's just for argument's sake say that the upliftment into the infrastructure required an investment of 10 billion rand by that private sector lessee or concessionaire into the container corridor. your ability as an investment, an investor into the infrastructure to enjoy the economic benefits of that infrastructure are directly related to the efficiency and the success of your infrastructure manager. So if the private sector is going to invest into infrastructure, the private sector is going to have to also be able to manage its infrastructure that it's investing into. We're going to see zero investment into infrastructure where you can't control the destiny of your investment. It goes without saying in any industry, on any investment that anybody makes. You want to be able to control the success of your investment. It goes without saying, and I haven't seen it in the policy papers, but it goes without saying that you are going to have the interoperation of multiple infrastructure managers in South Africa wherever you see the implementation of concessions. Look, everything said and done, I think that the opportunity regionally for us as a company is good. I think that there are going to be very exciting business cases for investment in South Africa, and we're already looking at a number of those in anticipation of what we believe will be a fertile investment market created by the terms and conditions of access in the network statement. So no matter which way I look at it and no matter which way I see the future, it's going to be an extremely exciting 12 to 24 months, not without its challenges, but if it was easy, everybody would be doing it.